Yes, well, welcome everybody. Yeah, Silent Storm, he is a sassy dog, especially when he doesn't want to leave the dog park, or sometimes he doesn't think his walk is long enough, and so when we go to turn to go up the stairs of the apartment, he lays on the ground. He weighs 80 pounds, and so if he doesn't want to move, it's difficult to move him. So sometimes what I do is act like I'm going to go around the block one more time, and he stands up, and then I dart for the the stairs.
Is that like the dog equivalent of like a child like holding their breath until they get what they want?
Probably. He just lays on the ground. Or if we're at the dog park, he runs to the other side. So we usually have to trick him. Yeah, this isn't dog, not compute.
Oh,
we got to talk about some tech stuff.
I have a cool tech thing that I experienced today, kind of, tangentially. So I got a call from a friend, Igor, in the chat here, who's actually watching for the first time. He calls me. He's like, do you have a view of the southern sky? And I'm like, let me get the compass app out on my phone. And go look outside. It's about 45 degrees. And so I go into my yard and look up and squinting. All of a sudden is like tiny point of light. Like, it's the middle of the day. It's like 10 a.m., right? It's perfectly bright out. It's not a planet. You can see the moon. It's not the comet NEOi. Like, that's too close to the horizon. I know it's not that. What in the world is this point of light hovering on the horizon? Like literal definition of like UFO, right? No idea what's going on over there. Let me pull up Flight Radar 24 app on my phone, see if it's on there. Sure enough, turns out it was one of Google's Project Loon balloons.
Oh, is it the internet one?
Yeah, so it's up at 55,000 feet. It coasted over our state from like northern Canada somewhere. As far as I know, they don't have any directionality. They can just like inflate and deflate to kind of like go up and down and kind of control where they go based off the wind directions. But other than that, like, they're basically just glorified LTE repeaters like in the sky. When I was on vacation in the French West Indies earlier this year, there was like a good half dozen of them overhead, which kind of makes sense in that area where it's like lots of sparsely populated islands spread out over a wide area, right? But over rural Connecticut, it was something else. And like, you could see it. And so I actually got some pictures. I'll put a link in the show notes. I pulled out my digital SLR and put on my crappiest, most telephoto lens and got a couple of pictures of it. It was pretty cool. You can very like clearly see the outline and the shape of it. The thing about it is, though, like, it is directly overhead. And again, it's supposed to like sort of passively take over like LTE coverage. So like, as far as I can tell, there's no way to know if my phone is on it. You know what I mean? Like, we're trying to figure out, could I do like a trace route and see like the path to see if it maybe hops through the balloon, or could I do pings and figure out the latency? I don't have any good way of knowing, like, am I on the Project Loon balloon? I have line of sight. I can see it. Like, I can see that, and I can't see a cell tower. So I'm probably connected to that balloon. But it was cool to see it floating around up there. X-Files theme starts playing.
That is really cool. I remember reading about, I didn't know it was Project Loon, but I remember reading that there was like internet balloons in the sky somewhere. But I've never actually like known what it was called. That's pretty neat. I put a link in the chat actually to it, so I'll have to read about it more because it's interesting. But it's interesting to think about, like, literally they are boiled down, they are just repeaters that float around in the air.
Yeah, and like, it totally makes sense, I guess. And they are mesh networked too, so I guess they will talk to each other if the, you know, they need to get the data, you know, further away than like point to point. Pretty cool project, but again, I don't really understand enough about it. The propulsion and like how they control where they go and how long they stay up there. So many questions, man. Such a cool project.
Yeah, I'm going to bookmark Flight Radar 24 because I think I've seen you. I think you've linked me to this before, but when I'm at the dog park, I always see helicopters going back and forth. Like, it's, I usually see, you know, two or three in the span of an hour. And I always wonder what they're doing. I think most of them are probably like medical helicopters. There's a small regional airport that's not too far away from me. But the other day I saw like a, they probably don't put military stuff on that, right? I assume they wouldn't put military.
I've looked every time I see something and it's never shown up.
Because I saw yesterday, I saw one of those dual rotor helicopters. I think it's called like a Chinook or something.
Yep.
It was super loud. Yeah, and it was it just flew on over. I was like, why? What is that doing here? This is really cool. All this aviation and like weather stuff you're into is really amazing to me. Like all this real time data. It's like I'm looking at flight. Actually, let me just pop a link to this in the show notes too. It'll be my location or near my location, but it's just all these planes flying around.
Flight Radar 24 is really cool because they have an AR view. So you literally just point your thing at the sky and it draws like a little label and shows what plane is flying over and exactly where it is in your relationship. So you can just kind of look up and point it at a plane and it's mostly like it gets
wow,
you in, the,
that's
in
cool.
the ballpark. Yeah.
That's really cool. Yeah, I'll have to check this. Like San Jose looks like if you've ever seen sharks from an aerial view, it looks like a pile of sharks.
Oh yeah, I mean that's like the general aviation capital of the world. Well, San Diego is really, but yeah.
Really? Yeah, the San Jose airport is stacked right now. So well, San Francisco's worse, never mind. That looks like a pile of fish on top of each other. This is really cool. I know that like you can ask Siri like, "Hey, what flights are above me right now?"
That's cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it gives you a list of their, I don't know what the technical term is, but the like the letters and numbers, like the call sign basically. Like it'll give you that, but it's nothing like this. Yeah, I've never seen a loon with my, it looks like a jellyfish in the sky, kind of.
It looks, yeah, exactly. There's no other way to describe it.
I mean, Jamie's here in the chat. She can correct me, but I think that's how jellyfish move around too, right? Or there's some sea creatures that move around by like inflating and deflating. They can go basically, no, that's it's a nautilus, right? They basically can just go like up and down, right?
Yeah. They have like a like ballast, like air or something.
Yeah, a ballast. That's what I'm trying to say.
Okay.
I could be wrong. She has a marine biology degree, and I do not.
Is there a marine biologist in the house?
I have a YouTube university degree. They use propulsion with water and air. Neat. So what's been up with you over there? I think last time we were talking about a little side project you had going, right? I think we mentioned that.
Yeah, I'm not even sure if I should talk about it. I didn't really discuss this with the person whose project it is, but.
Well, you don't have to talk about the project. More so, I guess what I want to get at was you and I were having a conversation about APIs and how often you can rely on people's information or their data or consistency, really. And, you know, I've been talking the last couple of weeks at length about my problems with data consistency, which is why I've been hanging out in Google Sheets for 2 weeks. And so I remember you like talking to me about wanting to use the SEC's API or their information, and it should be fine, right? Like they have however many billions of dollars or whatever, and their API should be consistent. And lo and behold, it is not. So I want to hear about that.
Yeah, it actually ended up being a really small number of things that actually made a big impact. So basically, here's the deal. If you're a large company with a lot of money, you're required to file this form called the 13F every quarter. And there are about 5,000 of these companies that do this every quarter right now. And if you have a value of basically over $100 million, you have to file this form. Basically, it's a listing of all your investments and how many shares of each thing you have and what the total value of those things are, whether it's shares or bonds or whatever. And you just have to report this, and it's publicly available information. And in 2013, they switched to a fully XML-based format for this. Previously, it was like plain text. I don't even know if you can parse it. Like, it was just kind of free-for-all, right? So in Q3 2013, they required that you submit this as an XML format. And the XML has PDF documentation that explains the whole schema. There's an actual schema for it. Fine. The file itself is actually this weird text file that has all this like pseudo tag header data at the beginning that looks like XML, but it's not. So I just parsed it out and ignore it because it's just garbage data. It's really dumb. It's just, yeah. But the actual XML data that there is pretty good. Most of my issues came from, well, number one, the XML parse that I use basically just had some bugs. I was just making some bad assumptions there. That's fine. The second issue that I had was that a good portion of these files were not UTF-8 encoded. They specified an encoding called Windows.
Oh no.
Windows 1252, single byte Latin character encoding. I'll be honest. I just did a red a string replace and replaced that with UTF-8 and just parse the data. Like, it's not perfectly correct, but it's good enough. And as long as it reads the data, it's probably fine.
I'll be honest. I don't think I've worked with anything besides UTF-8 encoding before.
If only we could all be so lucky. I didn't have time to dig into what the actual differences are. Again, just force the UTF-8, and then Erlang's built-in XM Erlang parser was happy. Great. By the way, I'm doing this all in Elixir.
I was about to ask. Yeah.
Sweet XML is the library I'm using. It's a nice wrapper around XMERL, which is Erlang's sort of OTP built-in thing. Sweet XML, the syntax for it is great, and it's friggin' fast, and it's just nice, man. It's just a nice way to read in data. So fix the encoding thing, figure out how to parse out these weird data. Great. I was able to actually import all the data without any errors. Cool. Then you actually start looking at the data and it imported. And yeah, there's this issue where you have to report the value of a particular investment as a number. It's an integer. It's in thousands of dollars. So if you say 123, that's $123,000. Okay, fine. Yeah, well, some people don't do that. They just report the dollar amounts. So some of your things are off by a factor of 1,000.
Right, okay.
Which, you know, when you look at something and they have $45 trillion, you're like, no, that's not right. Some of the numbers actually do make sense, even if they're wrong. Basically, what I do is calculate the median share price of all the investments for that quarter. Then I back solve. I'm like, okay, how many of these are off by a huge amount? All this is to say, yeah, it's kind of a pain parsing and fixing and munging up all this data, but holy crap, like Elixir is fast, you know? This is mostly IO bound because you're reading lots of data in from XML files, and then you're just like throwing tons and tons and tons of rows into Postgres. Literally just taking those processor intensive things, wrapping them in like a stream, a task async stream, so that they can basically just the really intensive thing can run concurrently or parallel. I can never remember which in the moment. You can run all those things at the same time. Like my MacBook Pro cruises through at like 1200% CPU, and in 2 minutes I've imported 1.2 million rows to the database, right? Like
it's just
the concurrency that you can get for literally just writing a function in a certain way that you know that it's you can just take advantage of that. Man, I'm convinced that Elixir is just a really good platform for taking streams of large data and chunking them up. And, you know, we're not even utilizing any of the like back pressure or anything provided by what's it called, Broadway and Flow and all that stuff. Like, I'm not even utilizing that. I'm literally just like, hey, take this really normally slow thing that we'd have to do serially and do it in parallel because we can, and you get all that performance for free. And also Postgres. Wow. What a hero. I just add a couple indexes and I'm still amazed by how fast and good Postgres is these days. So
yeah, Postgres is great. Well, that was, so with Sidedoor, so if anybody doesn't know, I kind of work on two apps. One is powered with Elixir in Phoenix, and the other one is Laravel. And so when we were working on Sidedoor, the only real technical constraint that I put on the team was, hey, we're using Postgres for our database. That's just it. Like, MySQL is probably fine these days. I don't have tons of experience with it. If we ever have to eject from, like, I don't know why we would have to, or I don't ever really seem that be a case. But if in my nightmares we had to eject from Laravel, we're on something that I understand on a fundamental level. Yeah, it's fast. Laravel, like, I've been running a lot of background jobs, like running, like importing this data that I've been cleaning 40, 50, 60, 70,000 SKUs right now. Laravel's fast, but Elixir is very noticeably faster. It's like, you know, it's fine. Like, Laravel's fine for what we're doing, but it is kind of this thing where I'm sitting here like waiting for something to happen. I'm like, this would probably be done right now if I were using Elixir.
So, real-time follow-up, Shai Ryan in the chat has pointed me to this GitHub issue that claims that there is a parser called Saxy, which is 1,000 times faster than Sweet XML, or can be 1,000 times faster than Sweet XML. So, you can bet I'm going to be looking into this. So, thank you for that.
Yeah, I haven't been doing that much programming. I've done some code tests. Like, I finished my React code test, and that was like my first big foray into React in like years. You know, I've done that. Like I was saying earlier, my Laravel programming right now, I've sort of been really busy during the week, and so I've been kind of in low power mode on the weekends. I haven't been doing weekend streams, like coding streams, just because I feel like just mentally tired at the end of the week. So my Laravel programming has been like a couple of files where I'm adjusting data or parameters that adjust data for me. So it feels weird. It feels like I haven't programmed in so long. So I'm kind of excited to get back into a little bit of DK to jump into Elixir, because I haven't touched Elixir in a couple months easy. It just feels so weird. These days feel so weird because I'm used to like programming all day, and now I'm not. I'm like talking to people on the phone and looking at Google Sheets and, you know, doing stuff like that. But beside that, I did actually kind of dip my toes into Unity and C# a little bit. Yeah, it's intimidating. Well, Unity is intimidating. C# not that intimidating to me. Unity itself is intimidating.
Yeah, I've also very, very tangentially played with Unity. I was trying to make a clone of Jetman or Helicopter Game. You know, the thing where you like fly through a tunnel and see how long you can last as the tunnel gets smaller and smaller and smaller and has like bigger deviations in it. That was my game that I tried to create in Unity and totally failed. I just made a guy who would like fly up and then he would just fall off into the abyss. That's as far as I got.
So the only other, actually, I'm trying to remember now. I did have a stint like years ago in RPG Maker when I was in high. I wasn't that cool in high school. I just made RPGs in my basement. But before that, my real first like game that I ever made was, I forget, it's Scorched Earth, I think it's called, Scorched Earth, where you have like two tanks on two hills and you shoot at each other and the hills disappear. I made that in BASIC in high school because I took a little intro to programming class in high school. Yeah, so I've been wanting to get into game dev for a little bit, and I have a friend that's working on a game, and he reached out to me and said, hey, do you want to potentially work on this too? And I said, yeah. So I wanted to jump into it. So Unity is a little intimidating, but the cool thing is right now that all of their courses, so they have a whole like academy, right? They produce all their own content or like learning content. It's all 100% free right now during the COVID stuff. So it's sort of good timing for that because you get actual like access to like their premium content, not just their basic intro stuff. So
what kind of resource are they? Are they videos or are there articles or what?
Both. There's videos, there's articles. They sort of have, they actually have projects you can clone down. And so it's like games that are sort of set up in stages. And so you jump to the next stage, it has pre-configured scenes for you, and then you do a couple of things and you can test play it. So that was sort of, you know, I only got through a couple. Like I said, my brain has just been, I've been so tired that it's been hard for me to really feel like I can sit down and focus. But I think I'm coming up on the end of this really busy season, so hopefully I'll get more into it.
Yeah, and like you said, C# itself is great, and I think the Unity APIs that they provide you are, well, I mean, you can see kind of the seams of where it's sort of grown and changed over the years. They don't totally conform to all the right like naming conventions you would expect and stuff, but it's still very approachable. But also, when you think about how sort of high level Unity really is compared to what came before it, and you realize how complicated even that is, and like how complicated Unity is just by itself, and game development, man, really, really twists your brain. Figuring out matrix transformations and like hacky ways to sort of squeeze performance out of things and simulate like what your, you know, what you see versus what's actually happening. Man, really, really messes with your brain. Just figuring out scale of things. Like in Unity, you have like, they kind of give you a world that sort of has like default, you know, Earth gravity, and but units don't have scale. So like if you make something too big, it's just going to fall really slowly, like a, like some kind of giant like mech or something. I assume the scale's meters, but I never really figured that out. I don't know, man. There's just so much stuff that you don't even think about when you're just, you know, want to shoot aliens.
Yeah, well, that's something I've always been a little bit jealous of, honestly, of like friend of the show, Paul, because throughout the years, he's always had these interesting side projects. So I remember when we were both working at a consulting firm back in the day called Octopus, he did like this space. He made like a Rails app, but it was like a text-based space game that had real simulated physics and things like that. And so he was like throwing all these equations at me. He's like, look, dude, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm just trying to like list stuff into, you know, like render things into a list and like put buttons on it, you know? But I think that's sort of what kept me interested in game development over the years, is the different ways you can sort of take the skills, like the foundational skills that you've learning, and apply it into something that's more interesting than just like database views. Cause like most of the web apps I've worked on have been glorified database views, really, if I think about it. So I'm hoping like getting into Unity kind of breaks me out of that. I feel like I'm sort of in a funk right now, you know, like I've been exploring different languages like PHP, Elixir, you know, digging deeper into JavaScript, now digging into C#. I did Go for a little bit for a job interview. And so with all of those, the end products are the same glorified database views, which are to me very boring now. They're sort of mostly solve problems. Like each business has their own business cases, obviously, right? But mostly what I've done is like glued things together, glued endpoints together, exposed endpoints to another thing, glued that together, you know? And so game dev is like the first area of dev that I'm trying to get into that's like completely and totally different. And so that's why I think Unity is so intimidating to me, is because it's like, how do I approach this thing? You know, like looking at a language, like, okay, so going from Elixir and then picking up Go. So basically I was interviewing for a job and I was given a week to pick up Go and build an API and ship that API and then let them test it, basically. And so approaching learning a language is like becomes easier every time you do it, because the concepts are the same. And so it's like learning the idioms of the language, right? But when I jump into game dev, it's like, okay, now I'm working with the UI. It's not just code first, it's UI first, right? And then you use a UI to glue things together. And then, like you said, it's totally different. So I've actually been looking at game dev streams on Twitch. And probably the most prominent one I've been watching is, I think her name, she goes by Lana Lux. And so she does, you know, she streams game development full time, basically. And the last couple of days she's been hanging out in Maya, and I learned that I am not interested in 3D modeling. It's so tedious. And she was doing I think it's called weight painting. So she was using like a weight brush to like change the mesh. So like you can move, like she was working on someone's neck and she was changing the shape of their neck and by like painting, and the more it painted, the more it moved it in or something. And I looked at that and I was just like, that, I don't want to do that. But the other stuff, like the net code and you know, that side of stuff is really, really interesting to me. And it's totally separate. Like Shy Ryan in the chat is saying, like, yeah, mostly what we're making are glorified Excel spreadsheets. And in fact, the last couple of weeks, I've been spending a lot of time in Google Sheets. And I'm thinking to myself, some of the functionality that's here, I was like, I would never want to remake this. I would never ever, I would rather like interface with Google Sheets than have to rebuild some of this UI, you know?
Yeah.
So that's what I'm hoping to get out of game dev, is like kind of break me out of that glorified Excel, like crappier experiences of glorified Excel sheets. I want to try to feel something fresh and different, I suppose. And so, yeah, hopefully Unity is going to do that for me. And now that I have a friend that's like assigning me GitHub issues, that I'm expected to do, I think now there's enough social pressure to get me to actually follow through on it.
Yeah, creating the content for games, man, that's a real blocker for a small or single developer, you know, team.
Yeah.
You know, now you understand why so many modern games are like pixel art. Oh, it's cool, 8-bit. No, it's just easier to design. Like, it's what one person can do. I mean, look at Stardew Valley, right? Like, that was literally one guy, and yeah, he worked his butt off. I'm not saying it made it any easier, but it made it possible for him to like design the world literally pixel perfect, like exactly how he wanted it to. And so yeah, that is definitely a problem with that, and it forces you to sort of get creative with solving the issues, right? Like a lot of small indie games use cell shading because you don't really need a lot of textures, and it kind of covers over weird polygons that are maybe low resolution. You know, stuff like that. You can play little games like that to kind of get away with it. And again, pixel art is like relatively easy to design. So the information density is pretty low, so you can slap some textures on there and it'll look pretty decent.
Yeah, so like Thor in the chat is saying, like, game development requires so much work in so many different areas of expertise and skills. Like, you have to develop so many different areas of skill sets to be able to produce something, I think, that's relatively polished. Another, I don't recall his name offhand. I'll try to put his name in the show notes, or his Twitch channel in the show notes. But he was talking, he makes like indie horror games. And he said his last game he released, he put over 2,600 human hours into it, which is like 110 days or something like that worth of work. And it's not his first, like, he's been doing it for a while. So that's like someone that knows what they're doing, putting you know, 2,600, more than 2,600 hours into a single product. I don't know that I've ever really worked, well, I guess like on DK, but it's not like...
Oh, listen, 2,000, there's 2,000 man hours in a year, right? If you work 40-hour weeks, yeah, that's 2,000 man hours in a year, so...
Yeah, so more than a year's worth of work into a single product that gets released, right? And I think like with web, we have it a little bit easier because we can launch and iterate quickly and things like that. And it's not, you don't have like release cycles in the same way that you would have in games and stuff. But that blew my mind. I was like, 2,600 hours. Besides a full-on day job, I don't remember any sort of side project I've ever had besides playing video games, which is not a side project. I've never, maybe like writing music or like doing something like that. But I've never like tried to produce something and put 2,600 hours into it, period. That blew my mind.
What do you think the game is that you have the most hours in? Do you know?
Diablo 2.
No hesitation.
Hands down. No hesitation. Because my brother and I used to run hardcore mode all the time. So Diablo 2, if anyone doesn't know, is an action RPG. So it's like top down of your character and you run around and you kill stuff and get gear, basically. We play hardcore mode, so when your character died, you can never get it back. That was really addicting to me because it was like, it made your heart pound. And especially back then when it's like, we barely have anything better than dial-up, you know? And you have any sort of net problems and your character's dead. It's not coming back. I don't know. That was really exciting to me for whatever reason. So I played Diablo 2 a lot.
Awesome.
But I'm trying to put myself outside of my comfort zone, I think, with the game dev stuff. And it's like more interesting to me. Right now, I feel like I have a hard time pulling up articles like, okay, I want to read more about React. I pull it up. Okay, docs are cool, but I have zero interest in like reading Medium articles about React. And at a certain point of my life, even just a couple of years ago, I would spend all my time like reading outside of the general docs. Like, what are people building? How are they building it? What's interesting, you know? And I'm not interested in that at all right now. And I think it's just because I need a little bit of a change there. So.
Yeah. One of the things that when I was playing around with Unity that really struck me was not even the game aspect of it, but just like I have a 2D/2.5D/3D space to like design whatever I want. Backing up a little bit, I did a summer internship where I had to design, basically make a educational movie. To do that, I had to learn basically Adobe After Effects is basically what I did the entire movie in, because it makes it really easy to compose lots of different assets and animate them and do particle effects and, you know, like do tweening, and it's like Flash on steroids, right? But it allows you to make like a really professional looking product. So I had to like literally learn Adobe After Effects from scratch. And Adobe After Effects is, it does have some 3D stuff, but it's primarily sort of, you know, 2D, like rendering simple animations, transitions, you know, that kind of stuff. And that was like mind bending for me, because to have the ability to like, it's not just Windows Movie Maker or, you know, iMovie, right? Like, this is actually manipulating things in free space and transforming them and adding effects and filters and all this stuff. And just like the tools and the platform provides you with just an open book of, you can do whatever you want as long as you know how to piece it all together. And when I was playing around with Unity, I got that same feeling. I'm like, oh my God, think of all the cool 3D visualizations I could make. Like, the first thing I tried to figure out was like, can I get a sphere and put the globe on it? Like some you know, texture of the globe and spin it and like, you know, rotate it at 22.5 degrees and that kind of stuff. And then I'm like, oh, can I do some cool animations, or could I do like a daytime, nighttime visualization? Could I show ham radio contacts? Right. Immediately I can start thinking about, you know, business related stuff, but can't help it. I wasn't even thinking about the game stuff. I was just like, oh my God, I have this cool platform for designing interfaces that are literally cross-platform. I mean, Unity runs on everything. It literally can even run in a browser, right? Mm-hmm. And like, granted, that's not easy, but it's something that you can accomplish something in a way that you couldn't do with any other tool set. And just that alone, forgetting about the game aspect of things, just having the tool set, just write some C# and move some stuff around in 3D space was really, really, I don't know. It's really cool.
I think it allows you to tap into that creative space, Right. And I think that's something that's pretty important to get into. And that could be, now that I think about it, what's affecting me is that I haven't really done for many years. That was really all I did. Like with music, it was just producing creatively and living in that creative kind of area. In the last several years now with this other stuff, I haven't been able to really be creative in a sense. Like, yeah, you can be creative in how you implement certain features. But it generally, especially in most business senses, it doesn't make sense to try to be creative about how you're solving the problem. Most problems have been solved. And so you should probably, in terms of being fiscally responsible to the people that are paying you, use some of those off-the-shelf things instead of reinventing that wheel. And I think, like, especially in my past, I've screwed up a lot in the startup world by trying to get that creative fix by, like, how can I solve this problem in a neat way versus using something that's totally acceptable, that's off the shelf. And it's kind of like balancing that. But I think not having that hobby of like writing music or playing, like performing or producing some sort of content. Like I think even the podcast, like for a while, I think early on, I mean, we're 200 and some episodes in, right? So it's been like 5 years. And early on, I kind of felt like getting that creative fix, but now it's like, it doesn't feel the same anymore. It's sort of like routine for me now. So I think like I'm hoping that, you know, jumping into Unity and stuff like that. And, you know, because I talked with this person and we're going to have to write music for it. And that's not something I've done in a while. That could be fun, you know, or like even getting on Twitch. Like there's obviously a lot of DMCA stuff happening, like copyright takedowns happening and videos being muted by, even if there's like a track playing in the background. And so there are apps out there like Pretzel that has all copyright free music. And the selection obviously is much thinner because it's people specifically saying, hey, this is fine to play, right? So I was like, well, the rock station's kind of all over the place. I could easily write a bunch of post-rock and just dump it on there. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So there's like another creative output that can feel productive at the same time. So yeah, I think like I've really come around to the idea, and as boring as it is, of like the business stuff is probably going to be boring, and that's fine. Like, don't reinvent the wheels if I don't need to, and find other outputs that I can be creative with that essentially cost me more money in the long run by like stepping out of the box or like inventing my own thing that has all these problems, when really, again, like I could have gone off the shelf and used something that's probably more battle tested. So I don't know, that's maybe like not necessarily, that's like a tangent I just got on, but the idea of like not living in a creative space, now that I think about that, I can definitely tell that I haven't been, because the feelings of like boredom or disinterest really take hold. And then if you're disinterested and bored, you're certainly not going to be able to learn and retain information about that information because you're not interested in it, you know? So it takes extra effort to be able to learn and retain when you're not interested. And then you start feeling like, maybe I'm not as good as I or need to be, or not as smart as I need to be because you're not interested. You know, it makes it harder.
To me, that makes it feel like a job.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have a particular idea in mind for Unity thing? Are you just exploring? Do you have any cool sort of projects you're working towards? Because I don't know about you, but
yeah,
my motivation is always in sort of projects and goals, right? Like what's the means to this end?
I need to clear it with my friend before I actually say what it is.
All right, don't worry about it.
But there's a chance I might be streaming game development.
Ooh, a teaser.
Yeah. There's that. I got to get my clickbait in, right? Or return bait, I guess. But yeah, there is a goal, I think, which helps. There's actually like a defined, like there's like a defined scope of this project, which also really helps. And there are things that are assigned to me that are supposedly like beginner friendly. So one of the things I'm going to be implementing first is like a history state, like undo, redo of things in the game.
Things.
So yeah. So that's like, I think that's what helping me make it feel more approachable, is like I have like bite-sized goals that are kind of outlined for me to tackle.
You have a box.
Yeah, exactly. I have a target, basically. Yeah, that's been my big update. So like I haven't had the energy to sit down and like program, but I've been, you know, I have the Unity docs pulled up on my iPad. And I've just been looking at, just trying to like browse through the API just see what's available, like in the Unity scripting engine, what I have access to, things like that. That's really like, that's really paid off well for me. I remember when we hired Paul, and he was working on Elixir for the first time. And before he actually started, before he even wrote any Elixir code, he read through the entire standard library a couple of times. And he wasn't like he memorized every, you know, module and function. It was more so that he had a passing knowledge of, like, he'll see a thing that he has to do and think like, oh, I read about this and it probably might be in this area. So it gives him more of a, like, a familiarity with everything. That's what I'm trying to do with the Unity stuff, is sort of like read the boring manual stuff, so that way I have some sort of passing familiarity with it, so I can find it easier.
There's a lot to read there, man. The docs are very thorough and also very dry, I found. Just, yeah. You know, I like reading things more so than sort of watching videos, but yeah, man, some of those docs will put you to sleep.
Yeah, yeah. It's I know I just talked about being bored and disinterested in things, but it's actually already like helped a little bit reading through, you know, seeing PRs get merged or opened up and looking at the code and starting, I'm like starting to recognize things, which feels good. It feels like I already have a little bit of payoff there, but yeah. Besides that, like work stuff, just Google Sheets all day, basically. So,
didn't you manage to crack? You managed to bring down Google Sheets the other day.
Well, I don't know if we did it, but Google Sheets was having issues.
I think you did it.
Well, we did hit. There's a 5 million row limit, I think, in a single a single project which we've hit. So,
oh god.
We have vendor project and vendor project 2.
You know, I think you said that on last week's show. Still cracks me up.
Yeah, yep. I can't remember. It's like 40 sheets or 5 million rows or whichever one you hit first, I think. 40 like tabs in one project, so
that's so they prevent you from like using all the free space as like arbitrary data storage.
Right.
Have you seen that? The Google FS or whatever? It stores all your data in Google Doc because it's theoretically unlimited.
Yeah, but there's so much like under the hood. It's like you crack it open and then suddenly it's like you start looking for plugins to do things, and then you crack it open. You're like, oh, actually, like Google Sheets can do this natively without having to install a plugin. Because then you start getting to like, okay, well, we have to buy a license for this add-on and that add-on and stuff like that. But like, so things like smart quotes, like why for, you know, denoting inches and feet and dimensions, like people will have, there'll be 2000 SKUs and one dimension will have a single smart quote in it. And of course I could just write the PHP to fix it, I guess. But
well, technically even the regular quote is the wrong one to use.
Yeah. And then I think there's one sheet that had like dimensions are like 15.01 or whatever. It would be like 15.01. So after the period, there's always a space in every single one.
Yeah, you mentioned that. That just makes my blood boil.
How did that happen? But yeah, so anyway, yeah, outside of Unity fun, it's really just been Google Sheets. Yeah, we can probably bring the recording down and then hang out for a little bit. If anyone has any feedback today, we got a lot of feedback in the Twitch chat, and that was awesome. Thanks everybody for chatting. And a friend of the show, Chris, CM Griffin on Twitch. I'll put his Twitch channel in the show notes. He screams like all day, every day. Great programming content. Right now he's doing Rust and WASM, he's building a game of something similar to the Game of Life. It's really, really cool stuff. But yeah, he rated us, and so now we have like triple the number of people chatting at us that we normally have. So yeah, shout out Chris. Thanks for you know, supporting us and everything. But we're even having like the derp stack being invented here, Django, Nginx, React, and Postgres. I mean, that's all, it's totally viable, you know. Yeah, if you have any other anyone has any other feedback or, you know, things they want to mention or tools or hot takes, anything like that, like let us know. We'd just love to hear from people.
I love the derp stack where like the D is hard, but it's from Django or you don't even pronounce the D. I saw one in Flyby in the Elixir Slack the other day. They called it the phlegm stack.
I've seen that.
Phoenix, what was it? Elixir, LiveView, and MySQL. The phlegm stack. Come up with your own anagrams. As always, you can give us feedback on Twitter, DNCcast. Sean is Sean Washbot, and I'm Shrockwell with a C. You can figure out where it goes.
And as always, our show notes will be available at dnc.show. So everything we talked about today with Flight Radar and Unity and Loon and Windows 1252 file encoding, that's even in there. I made sure to put it in there. So if you're looking for anything specific, head on over to dnc.show and you'll find the show notes there.
If you want to be part of the show, you can join us as we stream live on Twitch every Thursday night, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. One True Time Zone. That's Eastern. I should give it an UTC. We are we stream at 0100 UTC time. That's the real One True Time Zone. It's not even technically a time zone. Twitch.tv/DNCcast.
And last but not least, thanks to Spec for having us and putting us out in the world. They've been with us since day one, quite literally. We appreciate their support. And if you're interested in other design and development related podcasts, head on over to spec.fm and check them out.
I should have given the podcast start time in Swatch Beats. Put a link to Swatch Beats in the show note.
What is that even?
Don't even worry about it. Don't even worry about it. It's not even worth talking about.
Well, next week I should have a report for you on Unity, so we can follow up a little bit more on that.
I want a playable game on my desk by Monday.
I'll just share my desktop with you and you can play through the player preview if you want.
Yeah, I'll be like Stadia. Beta. Beta, beta, beta.
Well, cool, man. Have a good one.
All right, talk to you later.
Psych, we're still here.